Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today, it's the Renaissance in the Barroom, the return of what H.L. Mencken called America's greatest gift to mankind, the cocktail. Our guest is William Grimes, restaurant critic to the New York Times and author of Straight Up or On the Rocks, The Story of the American Cocktail. Consider this a case of show me your martini and I will tell you who you are. The king of the wine bargain, Joshua Wesson, joins us with a list of affordable white burgundies. Not an easy task. Reporter Scott Haas is trying to find out what makes Swiss milk so special. He reports from a pasture in Switzerland. Then we found a good reason to stock up on Cheerios, Cheese Whiz, and Cool Whip. Finally, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So we're ready to roll. Our favorite dining duo, Jane and Michael Stern, are stepping up to the mic. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, today we're going to tell you about a wonderful Creole soul food restaurant that Michael and I discovered on our last trip to New Orleans.
Oh, it's Creole soul food.
It's called Dunbar's, and it's near Tulane University. And this place, it's very modest. It looks like nothing from the outside. And, of course, in New Orleans, that's a sign of greatness very often.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, you walk in the door and you take one look. If anybody in there is eating a Dunbar's shrimp boat, you know you are in the presence of greatness.
Dunbar's shrimp boat is a foot and a half long piece, two pieces of French bread that have been, the dough
great
has
French
been,
bread.
Great French bread, absolutely, that has been, you know, the excess dough has been kind of scooped out, so it looks like, an Indian canoe, you know, and into this kind of, canoe-like, length of French bread, are probably about 3 pounds of freshly fried shrimp right from the fry kettle. They have a brittle crust on them that it's almost glassine when you chew it. I mean, it snaps like the best tempura in your mouth. But unlike Japanese tempura, of which I can never quite get enough of, you know, they always give you three beautiful shrimp and then you have to kind of eat them slowly. This is, you know, like 150 shrimp, so you can just scarf them down and just know that there are more, you know, waiting for you when you swallow that mouthful.
And it's so funny because the conceit of this shrimp boat is that it's a sandwich, as if you would pick it up off the plate and eat it, which is just such a ridiculous thought. You'd need a hoist to get it off the plate. Well,
you see, what you have to do, this is the Stern style of eating the Dunbar Creole cooking shrimp boat, is you eat all the dozens of shrimp, and then you pick up the bread, which has been saturated with all the shrimp juice and the frying oil and all the, you know, sort of debris and the good stuff, and then you eat about 3 feet of French bread afterwards.
This sounds perfectly reasonable. I see nothing wrong with this.
And then, but you have to save a little room for bread pudding.
Right, so it's bread
pudding.
Bread.
But, you know, something else occurs to me. You're talking about a city where the shrimp have not been frozen.
No,
those puppies were in the water, right? Like, you know, the night before or something. So they're really
swirling around.
They snap when you bite into them.
Wow.
And what's so great, Jane was talking about the crust. You can see the pinkness underneath the crust. I mean, they're sheathed in crust, but you can see that beautiful kind of that pink shrimp inside, and they really do snap when you bite them.
But if you're not a shrimp eater, I would also, you know, 100%, you know, positively suggest the fried chicken with red beans and rice, with or without sausage on the side, because whoever is the fry cook there, you know, does the chicken with the same incredible brittle crust as the shrimp. You certainly will not starve to death at Dunbar's Creole cooking.
And not
the portions are huge.
Now, not that I'm going to look up a lot, but if I do look up from the boat and the fried chicken, what's the atmosphere of the place?
It's a real neighborhood kind of soul food cafe, a combination of people who live around there, a few students, because the prices are so low. It's very attractive.
It's a very simple lunchroom, extremely friendly people eating there. I mean, Michael and I felt like, you know, we had sort of made 20 of our new best friends as soon as we walked in there. The one thing I would warn people about, I happen to really like it, but it's kind of challenging if you're a northerner or an easterner and somebody who's used to iced tea not being sweet. They serve pre-sweetened iced tea at Dunbar's, which makes glucose taste like green tea. It is the sweetest thing I've ever tasted in my life. I mean, it's delicious. And on a, 98 degree southern day, it's just, just the ticket for sort of getting you back in action.
Right.
But, if you don't like sweet tea, just, just be warned.
Hey, you two. Thank you.
Goodbye, Lynn.
Bye.
Jambalaya, crawfish pie, Billy Gumbo. 'Cause tonight I'm gonna see my machete meal. Pinky tall, feel through jaw, and he yells. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bayou.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. You can hear them here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. And hey, while you're checking out the website, come and join the conversation on the Splendid Table Forum. It's a place to talk food with the rest of us, everything from shopping to eating out to recipes and equipment. Find it at splendidtable.org. Expert Joshua Wesson approaches the beverage from his own unique stance. He sees nothing untoward about teaming a little of the grape with a Big Mac, and he believes in bargains. In fact, he's president of Best Sellers Wine Shop, where everything is $10 or under. Joshua, good to have you back.
I am happy to be here, and I'm happy to share something with you that I didn't think was possible.
Which is?
I found some white burgundies that you can actually afford to buy.
No.
Yes, it's
not
true.
Possible.
You know, it seems like a contradiction in terms, burgundy and value, because the quantities of these wines, are so small, and people charge after them with such enthusiasm and vigor that, they push the prices of these sought after wines up to the stratosphere. And to give you an idea of what really good white burgundy sells for by the bottle in a store, forget buying it in a restaurant, you're looking at $150, $200 a bottle for great, Chassin Montrachets and Poulinin Montrachets and Merceaux. I'm not talking about top of the pops here. I'm talking about, the middle of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy to spend that much money on a bottle of Chardonnay. And everyone out there should know that when you're drinking white Burgundy, you're pretty much drinking Chardonnay. In fact, it's the mother country of Chardonnay. And if you look in places where everyone else isn't, oftentimes you can find affordable white burgundies.
What do you mean by places where everybody else isn't?
Well, people who drink white Burgundy or people who've heard of Burgundy will usually be aware of places like Merceau or Pouligny Montrachet or Le Montrachet or Chassin Montrachet or even Pouilly-Fuissé. But if you skip those well-known regions of Burgundy, and you look sort of to the left and the right a little bit, maybe 10 miles this way, 5 miles that way, you can run into some great villages and some great producers in those villages that are what I call off-the-radar screen white Burgundies. And because people aren't charging after them, the prices aren't that high. In fact, you can find a raft of reasonably priced, and by that I mean $10 to $20 wines in Burgundy, even reasonably priced is higher than in other places, that are incredibly delicious. And in some cases, the wines that I'm going to talk about will outdo the more expensive, more vaunted, more famous white wines for a third, a fifth, sometimes a tenth of the price.
I am holding my breath. You must name names.
Yeah. Now, these are a little bit hard to pronounce, so, You better start furring your tongue and get ready to go with me. And these are the three villages or sub-regions of Burgundy that I think produce the greatest values consistently for white wines there.
All right, but now wait a minute. This is the name we're going to see on the bottle, right?
Right. In Burgundy, they classify their wines by both place and the name of the producer. So I'm going to name the place first, and then I'll give you a recommended producer and tell you a little bit about the wine.
Great.
Montagny, M-O-N-T-A-G-N-Y, and it's an entire white wine appellation, which is rare in Burgundy. A lot of times they'll mix it up with whites and reds, but they only make white wines in this town. And these people are very happy. You know, they ride around on their bicycles and they have bent frames and, you know, they have those jaunty little caps that they wear. And, you know, they all look like Maurice Chevalier in some 40s film. And they drink Montagny and they should be happy because the stuff is great and it's not expensive. And one of my favorite producers there is Bouchard, Père et Fils. And if you can find this wine, it'll cost you maybe $15, $20. And it's fat and rich, and it's sort of a stunt double for a Meursault. Really, really good.
Ooh, okay. More.
Well, if you like white Burgundies, or you like Chardonnays that are somewhere between lean, like a Chablis can be, and in your face, like a California Chardonnay can be, look to the village of Ruy, R-U-L-L-Y. And if you say this to a wine steward, he or she will be very impressed because it's sort of an insider little village. They make white wines and reds, but mostly whites. And one of my favorite producers from Rui is Rodet, no relation to the sculptor, and R-O-D-E-T. And he makes a Rui, which is just mind-bogglingly pure and delicious. It's floral, it's soft, delicately balanced, and it's a great mix of, you know, power and elegance. Wonderful wine.
Got any others?
Yeah, there's one more. Saint-Aubin. There are a couple of saints in Burgundy, especially in the southern part of Burgundy, that produce modestly priced great white wines. But Saint-Aubin is my favorite. And the domain of Roux, Père et Fils, R-O-U-X, makes a Meursault-like wine that I've stuck in bags and put next to Meursaults and blown people's minds because it only costs about $15, $16 a bottle. And this stuff is the Evander Holyfield of white Burgundy, the real deal, coming at you. And it packs a knockout punch, and it's really, really good.
Josh, you've made my month.
I practice when I'm alone.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Josh Wesson is president of Bestsellers Wine Shops. You'll find his white Burgundy picks on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the rise of the American cocktail, a cow pasture in Switzerland, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. Guess what's been called America's greatest contribution to the salvation of mankind? Editor and critic H.L. Mencken believed it was the cocktail. Now, the Salvation business is certainly debatable, yet cocktails are evidently all about us, our unique way with food and drink. Now, can you imagine a Frenchman creating a Jell-O shooter? More importantly, cocktails are back in style, with new creations cropping up faster than mushrooms after a rain. So it was only a matter of time before a serious food writer took on a study of the subject. That writer is William Grimes. He's restaurant critic to the New York Times and author of Straight Up or On the Rocks, The Story of the American Cocktail. Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, did we Americans create the cocktail?
We did, and we should be proud of it. It's our contribution to world civilization, and we got started on it very early. Obviously, other cultures had drinks that were blended, but it was Americans who did this unusual combination of mixed spirituous drinks with a lot of ice in it. And I think that still sort of amazes a lot of the rest of the world. This is our particular thing.
Was this something that came out of the Prohibition era?
No, much older than that. I think if you want to look at the mint julep, one of the very oldest cocktails, there are references to it way back before the 19th century, back in the 1780s. The martini, which people think of as kind of a jazz age drink, really was a classic by the 1890s or so. So a lot of pedigree.
Well, so it started in the 1800s?
It did indeed. The word first appears in print in 1806. And people were already using it, obviously. So you can go back even earlier than that. But cocktail itself, very early in the 19th century, is in print. And cocktails by the thousands were being mixed all over the country shortly after that, I would say.
Was this in bars or in restaurants? Where was this happening?
It was happening in hotels, which had bars. It was happening in saloons and bars. And you think of the word saloon, you think of swinging doors and maybe just a shot and a beer, but they were a lot fancier than that. You did have the very crude kind of ones, but if you go out to San Francisco with the Gold Rush days, no sooner had they put up a tent with a barrel of whiskey than it seemed like a week later they had a glittering palace of drink with crystal glassware and a fancy bartender with starched white uniform. And he would hand you a napkin to wipe your mustache with the drink. It became very formal very fast.
Well, you'd say that the martini is the touchstone of your book. So let's talk about martinis. They go way back. But what is it about the martini?
I think the martini is one of those mysterious, ineffable drinks. It's only got really two basic ingredients, vermouth and gin. Nowadays, more often, vodka. But they enter into some kind of strange magical synthesis that mystifies people, I think. And along the way, that classic glass, that geometric modernist-looking glass, added to the cachet. So something that had already been a classic back in the late 19th century became a double classic in a way, as it became a sign of modernity.
So what's happened today? I mean, the cocktail seems to have made this comeback. Why now?
Well, I think you have a more conscious, affluent audience for the drink and for the style associated with the drink. From the glamour era of the movies, for example, you see the cocktail presented in a very appealing kind of way. And I think there's nostalgia for that. And there's also a discerning public that cares about flavors and tastes and ingredients. You see that in restaurants. But that passion that's going into to sort of the restaurant experience is also translating into the bar experience or the drink experience at restaurants. So people don't want just a very crummy house brand of gin mixed with some soda. They want, or tonic, they want something a little more curated, you might say, or a little more chef-oriented. And that's a big interplay that I think is going on right now, that chefs who really care about the drinks that go on the table in their restaurants are meeting and coming together with bartenders and coming up with really great ideas and using new ingredients and bringing us into a new golden age, I would dare say.
So where, with this golden age, where does a Jell-O shooter or a fuzzy navel come in?
Well, you know, there is, it is a popular cultural form. Let's remember that as I compare it to the jazz or the cartoon strip or things like that. There's,
right.
there's an exuberance and a kind of craziness at the heart of the cocktail. And I think that's expressed in this, these kind of young people's drinks, like little blobby things of Jell-O with vodka in them that sometimes they slide them down little slalom courses carved into a block of ice. I mean, that's, I get a kick out of reading about that. I can't imagine doing it myself. I'm way too old for that. But even back in the first golden age, back in the late 19th century, there were really silly drinks being created every day, and most of them fell by the wayside. But then the martini wasn't a silly drink, and we still have that today. And I'm sure out of all of this silliness will come new classics for the next century.
Well, let's talk about some cocktail making tips. You've got a section in the book on recipes and then some ideas. Is the cocktail a great way to cover up sort of mediocre booze?
Yeah, the honest answer to that is yes, but as with anything that you drink or eat, the better the ingredients, the better the final experience. So I would caution against going for what they call well brands, which you would, if you went in and ordered an old fashioned at a bar, they would just reach for a very standard brand of bourbon and it wouldn't be very good.
Mm-hmm.
If you specify one of the higher end brands, you get a much better drink. But there is one exception I would make, and that is don't serve good champagne to make a cocktail. Get a decent sparkling wine. That is a case of where cheaper makes more sense than more expensive.
Mm-hmm. There's a trick you talk about, and it involves flaming, which I think always gets people's attention.
Yeah, and a lot of cocktails take a citrus garnish, you know, a twist of lemon, a twist of orange,
right,
or lime. What you can do is cut a very thick piece of the rind. This works particularly well with orange. And you kind of squeeze it between the thumb and forefinger, and you light a match, and the volatile oils in the rind will kind of poof into a little fast flame, and it will lay down a slick of slightly bitter citrus flavor on top of the drink, which is very beguiling.
So you're holding this over the drink.
You're holding it over the drink. You're doing a quick squeeze over a match that you've already lit, and the contact of the volatile oils with the flame will give you a little burst of more flame, a little fireworks there, and then it will, it won't all disappear. There will be a slight kind of residue that will put a little slick of flavor over the top of the drink.
Ah.
It's not as complicated as it might sound.
It sounds like a great way to show off, really. I'll just wear a
It is a show off.
I'm
going to
wear
yes.
a fireproof apron. Bill, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
William Grimes is author of Straight Up or On the Rocks, The Story of the American Cocktail. Mr. Grimes left us with a couple of drink recipes that we're going to be putting up on the website, including a recipe for the Vesper. This is the James Bond martini named for his doomed love interest in Casino Royale, Vesper Lind. You can find them on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the homepage, take a look at the Splendid Table store. It's a collection of foods I've taste-tested and really liked. And we've got some new additions, including something very new or very old, depending on how you view it. It's a spice called Grains of Paradise, and it was trendy back in the Middle Ages. Anyway, take a look at the Splendid Table store at splendidtable.org. Some folks go to Switzerland for the chocolate or even the fondue, but reporter Scott Haas has a thing for Swiss milk. Milk is at the heart of Swiss cuisine and is a big player in the Swiss economy. But what makes it taste so good?
This is Scott Haas, and I'm in the Bernese Mittelland, which is just north of Bern in Switzerland. And that's a cow. And I love Swiss milk, and I decided to come out here to this farm and find out why Swiss milk is so delicious. I mean, when I've come to Switzerland, one of my favorite things to do is have a nice, big, tall glass of milk. And I'm surrounded here sort of like an explorer from National Geographic, not by polar bears or chimpanzees, but by 30 of the most beautiful Swiss cows I've ever seen in my life. They're brown, and they're white, and they're spotted. They look so healthy that they look like a glass of milk on four legs. And I'm lucky enough to be here on a Swiss farm as an explorer with an expert on Swiss farms, a man who grew up on a Swiss farm, but who now... Tell me your name, please.
I'm Wally Bütikofer.
Well, thank you so much for coming out to this farm with us. But what do you do now? You grew up on a farm. You grew up in this neighborhood?
Yeah, I have been working for 20 years on a farm. And because the farm was not big enough to be really a place for two men, then I left the farm because my brother was really the big farmer.
Okay, and so, but you still stay connected to farms in your work. What is your work now?
I'm now working at the Swiss Federal Dairy Research Station in Liebefeld, where we have really a very strong relationship to milk producing and then to cheese production too.
So are you the person responsible for making this Swiss milk as tasty as it is? Do I owe you some thanks?
Oh, that would be, I think that is it's not possible for me. It's really the cows.
The cows.
And the grass, which is responsible for this really very good quality you have on Swiss milk.
All right. Okay. Well, we've just crawled under the electrical wire around the field, and now we are running with the cows. We're standing right next to this cow right here, who's very, very warm and pampered and sweet. It is interesting to me, really, how integrated the agriculture is in Switzerland with normal life. Oh, they're coming over to say hello. We're surrounded by about six very large cows. You know, I prefer it when they're more timid. They are beautiful, though, huh?
No risk. It's just to pay attention on the horns.
On the horns.
Because if they pick you up, then you will stay for a few months here in Switzerland. Yeah.
But they're not aggressive. I mean, cows.
It depends.
It depends.
It should normally.
But no, I don't usually think of cows as a dangerous animal. I hope that they look very friendly. They're quite forward. So I know that Swiss think in terms of liters. How many liters does a day does one of these cows typically produce of milk?
Typically about 20 to 30 liters per day.
So what is that about? You divide it by four, so about 7.5, 8 gallons, more or less? Five to seven gallons?
Yeah, per day.
And is that the same as American cows?
No, it's much lower production.
Really? Well, how much what is it because American cows are big and strong? American cows, they produce bigger and better? Or what's the story behind that?
No, I don't think that, because you have a big difference between a European milk production and U.S. milk production.
Uh-huh.
In Europe, it is forbidden to use this hormone called somatotropin to make milk machines out of this nice cow.
So how much does an American cow produce each day?
I think about the double.
Double?
Best. Yeah.
So what happens? I mean, does this wear the cow out, or is it the same? I mean,
you will see. You have this cows here in average age of 6 to 10, 12 years old. Uh-huh. You will never find that in the States. They will be dead after 3 to 4 to 5 years.
Because of the overproduction?
Yeah, they are really killed after this very short production time.
Huh. Do you think you can taste the hormones? I mean, you can't know.
No, cannot taste the hormones. You will not find them even in the milk.
Okay.
It's not.
It doesn't end up in the milk.
No, it is so small concentration that you will feed to the cow, even inject it, and it's very...
So it's more a matter of principle.
Yeah, it's really a matter of principle, yeah. No, we have a very different relationship to the animals. We really, that not only the man is happy and to have most of the money, most of the income, but even that the animals are happy too. They can really live here and not only to be here just for the milk production.
You know, I have to say, I was really struck by that because on the way out here, I saw things that you just don't see in the States. The farms were right next to, a grocery store, a residence, a doctor's office. The farms were really absolutely integrated into the community. You just don't see that in the States anymore.
You can go to all the people here. They know what is a cow. They do not just know what is a package of milk. They really know what is behind it.
Can we taste some of this milk?
Yeah.
It's no problem. Okay. This is a beautiful picture. And why is there a strainer on top of it?
You see, you have of this raw milk, we have here, we have a lot of fat. That means that will build up some cream.
So we're going to skim the fat off.
Yeah, skim off.
All right, well, I'm going to have a glass of milk because this is, in fact, one of my favorite things to do. That's delicious. I mean, it tastes very sweet. There's a sweetness about it that when you have ordinary milk, it doesn't taste so sweet. So you don't add, there's no sugar that's been added to this. Why does it taste so sweet?
That is the original lactose you have in milk, which you have in all milk, but it's really depending on how the milk was treated before, because you have here a milk that was just fresh in the morning from the cows.
This was from this morning I'm drinking?
This from this morning, The treatment was very soft. It was about 70 to 80 degrees Celsius just to heat up.
Right.
To pasteurize. But normally if you buy milk in the store, it is heated up to 140 degrees Celsius.
Well, this is classic because it's typical that if you find something wonderful and tasty, you should do as little as possible to it. And that's what this milk is about.
Yeah.
So I think I understand a lot better now why Swiss milk is so good.
Yeah? Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you so much for showing me. I really have learned an enormous amount about Swiss milk.
Okay. Thank you for the visit.
Tribuse, Tribine, den Reihen an Stimme. Bringt erst die Riechelhuhe.
That's a traditional cow call. Scott Haas lives and eats in Boston. And just one caution from the food police side of my nature. If you're tempted by raw milk in this country, just make sure it's health certified first.
If you're feeling sad, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only. I can be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 and we will talk. Well, let's get right to it. We've got Jack on the line. Hi, Jack. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Got a question for you.
Okay.
Been living in the same house for, was living in the same house for 22 years, and in the process of moving from that one to another, discovered a number of hidden treasures up in the cupboards. Including some saffron that I know friends gave me years ago when they came back from Spain, and another friend came back from Middle East and brought some saffron for me. It's dried. It's no longer that brilliant, vibrant yellow. It's kind of pale golden and still intact as far as I can tell. I guess my question is it still good?
Oh, probably pretty much faded out. How does it smell?
Nothing that I've noticed.
That's the problem.
Okay.
I don't know if you do this, but I do this. When something is really precious, and, you know, saffron is evidently the most expensive spice by weight in the world. It's like $1,400 for a pound of it or something like that. You put it away to save it for something special. And at least I do that. And, you know, 5 years later, I find the stuff and it's toast. And you can't, it's not going to give you very much at this point.
Okay.
Yeah. But there are spices that last quite a while. You know, like, for instance, peppercorns, whole peppercorns. Yeah. As long as they're away from light and heat, and that's true of any seasoning, you know, keep it away from light and heat, peppercorns will last a year, even a year and a half or 2 years, depending on how fresh they were to begin with.
Great. Thanks for your help.
And use up the goodies.
I will.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Let's take a break for our weekly trivia question. Today's question is, what is the Viagra of North Africa? And yes, it is related to food. We're going to be back in a moment with that answer and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. The number's 800-537-5252, and we will talk. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, what used to be the Viagra of North Africa, and much of Europe for that matter? It was Spanish fly. Now, you've probably heard of it. I think it should really have been called North African beetle, since it's actually the powdered bodies of a bright green beetle from there. Supposedly, Spanish fly is the only true aphrodisiac food. Everything else is more about imagination than actual science. It works like this. Spanish fly contains a gastrointestinal irritant that increases blood flow. The catch-22 here is that it also damages the kidneys and it can kill you. From where I sit, it's bad enough eating bugs, but dying from them? Ugh. Anyway, none of this stopped the Marquis de Sade from lacing bonbons with Spanish fly, or Lord knows how many wannabes from using it in all kinds of nefarious ways. Thank goodness, though, the bad old days are over. Spanish fly won't be killing any more overzealous types because it's been outlawed almost in the entire world. Historian Alan Davidson, in his book The Oxford Companion to Food, talks about the tall tales you hear about Spanish fly in Morocco. My favorite story is this one. A Moroccan was asked if he ever experimented with it. He explained that his wife once added it to boiling spaghetti. And when she went to serve the spaghetti, every strand was standing up absolutely straight. Talk about urban myth? Okay, let's get back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Jane on the line. So, Jane, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'd like to talk about making pies, specifically fruit pies.
Uh-huh.
But it's also a problem I have with pecan pies because it has to do with the sugary, syrupy stuff that gets in pies.
Right.
When I make fruit pies, I like to make like a four-berry pie, and I like them really juicy. And they come out wonderfully, except that the sugary, syrupy juice slips underneath the pie crust. Mm. And then you can't get it out of the pie shell.
Yeah.
I mean, I dig away, of course, but it doesn't make beautiful slices of pie. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions for what I could do to alleviate
it. I'll tell you what comes to mind. First of all, the other thing I don't like about that kind of stuff is that the bottom crust, you know, turns to sog. It's
yeah.
like eating oatmeal with a spoon. I'll tell you who comes to your aid on this one. She is a baking genius. Her name is Rose Levy Barenbaum.
Uh-huh.
And she did a book, I think it was called The Pie and Pastry Bible. It came out a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And Rose really is gifted because she understands the science of baking as well as the art of baking. So her stuff tastes great, and also her recipes work.
Oh, wonderful.
If I can just throw in a small opinion here,
uh-huh.
a lot of people who write about baking don't have a clue about the science behind it.
I can imagine that's true.
Yeah, I mean, and their stuff may taste great, but if something goes wrong, they don't understand it, and sometimes they work sort of backwards. But that's beside the point. This is what she came up with for the fruit situation, and when I read it, it was like a light bulb that went off. You know, why didn't I think of this?
Mm-hmm.
When you mix fruit and sugar, what happens is the sugar literally draws moisture out of the fruit. Yeah. And, you know, what a lot of people do with fruit pies is they add a lot of thickener. Well, to me, that's like eating cardboard paste.
Uh-huh.
So what you do instead is you make that juice an ally. And here's what she suggests doing. You take whatever the mix is of your filling. Let's say if you're doing all those berries, you have a cup of sugar and maybe a pinch of salt and maybe cinnamon. Whatever it is that's going to be in your filling.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You put that all in a strainer over a bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And you forget about it for a half hour.
Mm-hmm.
Go and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And when you come back, you will see that that sugar has started to leach a lot of the liquid out of the berries.
Ah.
Aha. So what you do is, and you can leave it longer if
right.
you want to. What you're doing that then is you're going to take that juice, pour it into a saucepan, boil it down to a very thick syrup,
and add that back to the fruit. Now, normally with a berry pie, you have a little bit of flour or some thickener in it, but you don't have to overdo it because with this trick, you get like this essence. Try it with any kind of fruit pie.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and you know, I've left it for an hour and had it work just fine.
Wonderful. I wonder if you could also answer a question about ripening mangoes and pears and
sure,
pears.
Sure.
I buy them at the grocery store, and maybe I'm not buying high quality stuff, but I take them home and I let them sit out, or I put them in brown paper bags, and they
and
just,
nothing happens.
Right, or they just rot instead of ripen.
It's tricky because I mean, especially now, pears, you know, are always picked unripe. They don't ripen on the tree, which is kind of interesting. And the way you know a pear is ripe is you go up to the shoulder of the pear by the stem and you press. And if there's a little give, that pear is ripe because it's ripening from the inside out.
Okay.
And by the time the outside is kind of soft, the whole outside, you know, what's in the inside. Yeah, it's toast on the inside. Yeah. But so what I, you know, the thing is, put it in the paper bag with a sliced up apple.
Okay.
Because it's the ethylene gas that the apple throws off that helps the ripening process with the fruit.
Great. Will that work with a mango as well?
I think it will. Now, there are some fruits that get to taste better if you do that. Some fruits just get softer, but the taste doesn't change. And I can't remember which or which. But the thing is, the mango, I think mangoes improve for sitting like that.
Okay.
Yeah. And if
so
you run
a slice of apple.
Right. And by the way, if you run across, there are small yellow ones that come from Mexico.
Yeah.
And they're organic sometimes.
Uh-huh.
I have had constant luck. I don't know what they're called, but boy, they end up being so sweet you could just die.
Oh, my, because the ones I was getting, I think, were like from someplace like Ecuador or somewhere farther south.
We're not going to be picky about origin.
I'm not.
But anyway, and someone just from the control room, because they're on top of things, they just told me they're called champagne mangoes.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that classic?
Cool.
Hey.
Okay, wonderful.
Hey, Jane, enjoy and try the paper bag with the cut-up apple.
Thank you so much for your advice.
You are welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. I am just back from a great trip to Santa Fe. We spent a week there. The one stunning thing about Santa Fe, aside from the great artists and the crafts and the scenery and the whole environment, are the prices in a lot of the restaurants. Dinner can run for two, maybe $90. So we set out to find some great bargain places, and I called Deborah Madison, you know, the author of cookbooks, the wonderful vegetarian author, and Deborah lives there, and she told me about a place that if you go to Santa Fe, you really have to try. It's called Bobcat Bite. This is where a lot of locals eat. It's about 4 miles out of town, and it's a place that is open from the morning until 7:40 in the evening. Not 7:45, not 8 o'clock, but 7:40 in the evening. There are 5 tables plus a counter, and their great specialty is green chili cheeseburgers. I am talking here sloppy, juicy, so succulent, so tasty, not wildly hot and spicy, but just enough nip. And what I suggest you do, by the way, they are $5.50. This is compared to $45 for a dinner. Now, what I suggest is that you splurge another $1.50 a piece and get the homemade potato salad and the homemade coleslaw. The coleslaw is sweet, sour, with kind of poppy seed caraway flavoring. And the potato salad's that good old-fashioned. They made it with boiled potatoes that they cooked themselves, you know, with the mayonnaise and the whole thing. It's called Bobcat Bite. Santa Fe, great way to save money. Now, we're taking your calls this hour. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Michael has been waiting. So, Michael, what do you want to talk about?
I was listening to your show in WNYC a couple of weeks ago, and I was very amused to hear you practically fawning all over this guy who is the cook in his family's household. And the reason I found that so funny is that myself and a friend of mine were actually going to culinary school right now. We're going to Peter Kump's School of Culinary Arts here in Manhattan.
Right.
And a large part of that has to do with the fact that we're doing it so we can meet women more easily. And I have to tell you, it's
working. It's working.
It's working very well.
All right. Tell me how it's working.
Well, What's the best way to describe this?
Didn't I?
And still be a gentleman. well, obviously, any woman is very interested in romance and also being made to feel that she's special.
Right,
probably one of the best ways to do that is to cook her a fine meal. And the other nice thing I like about doing something like this, too, is it's a great topic of conversation that you can have with somebody. And everybody likes food. So it's just a great thing to be able to talk about. But, you know, the nice thing about going to a place like a place where you study classic French cuisine is you learn to be a little bit of a showman, which I think helps out there, too.
So, oh, that never hurts. I mean, do you actually have your lady friends or your women friends come up and cook with you or be there while you are cooking?
Well, one of the things you learn about French cuisine is, one of the nice things is about what you can do ahead of time and just have sitting around and what you can do right there in front of somebody. So, for instance, you might do a flambéed bananas and get those set up just right. But then, of course, when you light everything on fire, you can do that at the end of the meal.
In more ways than one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but no, I have to tell you something. I think you're brilliant. I really... No, because I don't think anybody, a man or a woman, can resist this idea of someone making them a meal. I mean, it's an old story. But the other thing, I have to tell you, though, a buddy of mine who lives in Colorado told me his problem with a lot of women, he loves to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And like you, he put two and two together and figured out this wasn't a bad way of having a date. But he said what he's running into is people are so health conscious that he said he had two dates where he was ready to throw them out of the apartment because they kept saying, I can't eat that and I don't like that. I know that's bad for me and that's too much salt. Have you run into any of that?
Well, I don't associate with people like that because they're usually have slightly pasty complexions and they just don't know how to enjoy life very well. You know, I will say this, is that one person who I'm definitely having a wonderful time with, she's a fitness instructor. And she's sensible enough to realize that, you know, you have to cut loose every once in a while. In her case, it's even nicer because she's got a young daughter who actually I do enlist her help when I cook.
This sounds like a keeper.
Yeah. Yeah.
This sounds like a keeper.
Might be.
So how many cooking lessons have you had?
Well, let's see. I'm taking my second course there. I've had at this point 8 5-hour courses at the Peter Kump School.
I'm impressed.
And
I am impressed.
The biggest thing I think I want to stress to any of the gentlemen out there is that it's not complicated stuff if you know what to do and you watch somebody do it. If you can wield a hammer, you can use a knife or a saute pan, and people get really impressed when you know what something like mirepoix is all of a sudden.
I think this is a great tack.
I agree.
Hey, thanks a lot. We will fawn over you as well. Hey, you know, we have a lot of men who call the show, and I know there are a lot of guys out there cooking. And it's always great to hear from you.
Thank you, Lynn. Bye.
And no, we are not giving Michael's telephone number out. Well, a new book landed on my desk with a pretty amazing, you could almost say preposterous, title. It's called Clean Your Clothes with Cheese Whiz, and it's by Joey Green. Since I'm the one who always ends up with some of my lunch on my blouse, I thought maybe I should give him a call. Joey Green, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Lynn.
Joey, what possessed you to try to clean something with Cheese Whiz?
You know, I should probably explain that whole idea there. I mean, you really can clean your clothes with Cheese Whiz, as crazy as it sounds. You know, if you've got a bad grease stain on your shirt or your pants, say you've been out in the garage, you know, working on the car or a bicycle, a grease stain is just not going to come out of your clothes. But if you just take some Cheese Whiz, smear it over the grease stain, let it sit for 5 minutes, then throw the garment in your regular wash, the natural enzymes in the Cheese Whiz, and there are natural enzymes in Cheese Whiz.
There's something natural left in that stuff?
There really is. And those natural enzymes will actually break down the grease stain, comes right out of the clothes. And what's nice is you could be having, you know, nachos while you're doing the laundry, which isn't something you can do with your regular detergent.
You talk about A1 sauce. I would imagine that would be a stainer par excellence. What do you do with A1?
A1 steak sauce is great. Well, say, you know, Lynn, you're at a restaurant, you've got a big date, you look down at your shoes, you realize they need polishing. All you need to do is grab that A1 steak sauce that's sitting right there on the restaurant table and just with a napkin, just put it on your shoes, rub it in. You can shine your shoes with A1 steak sauce.
So what possessed you to try A1 steak sauce?
Well, I get all my ideas, actually, from Americans all across America. It's a good place for them, I guess. And people email me all the time and write me letters, and they also write to the companies with all their unusual uses for the products, kind of American ingenuity at work. And, you know, people in a pinch, when they have nothing else to do, they try anything and find out it works. What's nice about A1 steak sauce on your shoes is, you know, pets will love it. They'll keep licking your shoes, keeping them nice and shiny for you.
If it cleans my shoes, I wonder what it's doing to my stomach.
Keeping it nice and clean.
Well, do you have any real favorites out of all of these things you've tried?
Well, if you go to a salon, you know, to get a facial, it's quite expensive, you know, $50, $60, $70. Actually, you know, if you're having Cheerios for breakfast, you can give yourself a facial at the exact same time. And all you do is you take 2 cups of Cheerios, put them in a blender, it takes 1 minute of your time, grinds them into a nice fine powder, then mix equal parts Subi honey and real lemon juice, and it's a real nice sticky, gooey mixture. You put it on your face, you'll wonder why in the world you're doing this to yourself, it feels so sticky and gooey. But when you clean it off with cool water about 10 minutes later, you will not believe how amazing it feels. Now think about it, the Cheerios are oats, so they dry the oils from your skin. The honey is hygroscopic, so it moisturizes your skin. And the lemon juice has citric acid in it, so it actually is an antiseptic. It cleanses your skin. So combined, it's a really amazing facial treatment that you'd pay a lot of money for at a salon.
So where are your breakfast?
Exactly. And one of my favorites, I've been demonstrating this for a little bit now, is giving yourself, conditioning your hair, actually, with Cool Whip, the non-dairy topping.
I knew there was a use for it.
And it's great because it makes you feel like a dessert, which is a nice feeling. And you just put the Cool Whip in your hair, you leave it in 5 minutes, wash it out. It's a dessert topping. It's a hair conditioner.
Joey, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Joey Green is author of Clean Your Clothes with Cheese Whiz. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with a quote from Fran Lebowitz. Ask your child what he wants for dinner, only if he's buying. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Now, while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store. It's where you'll find some of my favorite foods and seasonings, and it's full of some of the things I like to have in my kitchen. Right there on our homepage at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.